Company, ready!
The Chronicles of the American Civil War begins now. And here's your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena.
Welcome to the podcast. This is program number 35. If you are a new listener, please check out the other 34 archive programs also. If you are a regular, we appreciate greatly your listening. We broadcast from the new podcast studio at room 205 in the Good Building, 113 West Liberty Street in Charlestown, West Virginia. Logistically, the podcast will post each Thursday afternoon and is available on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Google Play. Today's book information is this. An autographed book is always a great gift. You miss out when you buy an ebook because your book cannot be signed by the author. The author also loses when you purchase an ebook. While it is true that I make 70% royalties on a sale of my ebooks sell for far less than an actual printed book. For instance, a book I sell for $20.95 may sell for only $2.99 as an ebook. Also, Amazon.com loves to give away ebooks. How much do you think I make when you get a free ebook? I get nothing. Zero. Zilch. You can love your ebooks. Authors don't like them at all. Keep that in mind with your next book purchase. If you want to find out information on my 12 published books about the American Civil War, please visit my website at www.BobOConnorBooks.com. You are listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. My guest today is Joe Makowski. Joe is the author of several books, including one we will be talking about today, Jefferson Davis and His Cabinet. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, it's great to be here, Bob.
Thanks for coming. Please provide my audience with a little bit of background about who you are.
I sure will. Well, again, my name is Joe Makowski. I grew up in Reading, Pennsylvania. Spent a long career with the federal government, most of it in Washington, D.C., but about 20 years ago, we moved to the Gettysburg area, and I got immersed in Civil War history. Ultimately, I became a licensed battlefield guide at the Gettysburg National Park. I'm the past president of the Gettysburg Civil War Roundtable, and I'm just immersed and steeped in Civil War history, and got to know you and enjoy your friendship.
Thank you. And you live in Fairfield, Pennsylvania?
I do live in Fairfield, Pennsylvania, along the very route that Robert E. Lee's army retreated in the days after the important Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah, we would ask him about that last week if we had known.
There you go.
Could you give us a little bit of an overview about your book on Jefferson Davis and his cabinet?
I sure will. You know, if you've heard the term that war is politics by other means, you'll understand the reason I put this book together. Because so many studies of Civil War history have to do with the important generals. General Grant, General Lee, General Meade. But, you know, I was a lifelong bureaucrat, and I realized that politics mattered when it came to war. That was true then, and it's true today. Now, the most important book, arguably, ever written about the Civil War was Team of Rivals, about Abraham Lincoln and his cabinet. So I studied that extensively, and it made me wonder what books are out there on the Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, and his cabinet. Who were those politicians that he surrounded himself with? And the more I researched the subject, the more interesting it was. So I did have a book out, Jefferson Davis and His Cabinet. Essentially, it's a listing of the biographies of these great statesmen.
And when did that book come out?
This book came out about 3 years ago.
Okay. How did the Confederate cabinet compare to the one that Lincoln put together?
Well, to understand the Confederate cabinet, it helps to contrast it with Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. That team of rivals, when Abraham Lincoln became president, he made it a point to select the most talented men in the country, even if they were his political rivals, to place in the cabinet. So William Seward of New York will become Secretary of State, even though he wanted to become president, was right, expected to be president, even before Abraham Lincoln was able to win the office. Salmon P. Chase of Ohio became the Secretary of the Treasury. And the list goes on and on of some very talented men that went into Lincoln's cabinet. He tried to pick people, even if they were political rivals, who could be of value to the country. Jefferson Davis, however, had another object in mind. Because of the philosophy of states' rights, when the Confederate cabinet and Confederate government was formed in 1861, Jefferson Davis was anxious to make sure that those Confederate states had representation in the Confederate cabinet. So he was more likely to pick somebody from Virginia because they were from Virginia, somebody from Louisiana because they were from that state, somebody from each of the northern state of the southern states, Alabama and so on, put them into the cabinet because they represent the interests of that state rather than the interests of a controlling government, as it were. So that's the first contrast with
Lincoln. So he didn't necessarily pick the best men because the best men might have all come out of the same state.
Exactly right. Or the most prosperous state or the most economically important state. If he had gone on that criteria, there would have been a whole lot more people from Virginia in the Confederate cabinet.
That's
but instead, he reaches elsewhere in the Confederacy.
Right. I was surprised to read about his cabinet. That it fluctuated during the war and that there were actually 16 men who served in various positions. Why do you think that happened?
Well, interestingly enough, because these men were representing their individual states, they came at the Confederate government with a variety of perspectives and didn't always agree with the way Jefferson Davis was conducting the war. So, for example, there were a lot of soldiers in Georgia who greatly disagreed with the way Jefferson Davis of Mississippi was conducting the war and, in fact, ultimately would serve to undermine Jefferson Davis's interest. So over time, these soldiers got less enthused about Jefferson Davis and the Confederate government and more enthused about leading brigades, regiments, and divisions in the Confederate Army. So a lot of prominent men would go into the Confederate cabinet only to become quickly disillusioned with the Confederate policies and request their way out of the government to lead army units. So people like Leroy Walker, who had been the Secretary of War, for example, will go to become an important Confederate general rather than a bureaucrat in Jefferson Davis's cabinet.
That's really interesting.
That was true of Robert Toombs. That was true of Howell Cobb, the very first president of the Confederacy, the president of the Provisional Congress, and so on. A lot of these men went into the government and then quickly found their way out.
And the people around here would recognize the name Toombs from the Burnside Bridge at Antietam.
Yeah, they sure would. Robert Toombs from Georgia, one of those famous Georgia politicians I referred to. He had been the Secretary of State in the Confederacy, but quickly became disenchanted with Jefferson Davis's policies. He had imagined himself as an important diplomat, only to find out that there was very little diplomacy conducted in the Confederacy. So he will leave the Confederate government, and he will find himself on the other side of Burnside's bridge at the Battle of Antietam in 1862.
Yeah.
In fact, when we cross Burnside's bridge, people remember those soldiers from the north crossing the bridge. They forget who was shooting at them, those soldiers from Georgia
and those
under
guys
Robert Toombs.
Giving them a hard time, too,
I'll
even
say,
though there weren't very many of them.
Bodies floating down the Antietam Creek. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Alexander Stevens was Davis's vice president, and I believe he was actually a friend of Abraham Lincoln.
He was a friend of Abraham Lincoln. You know, a lot of the generals became good friends during the Mexican War. Well, it was also true of politicians. Prior to the Civil War, in the mid-19th century, a lot of these men were well acquainted. The politicians were well acquainted. You might remember Abraham Lincoln had served in Congress prior to the Civil War, and one of the other people serving in Congress was Alexander Stevens from Georgia, who would later become vice president of the Confederacy. So it's one of the ironies of history that two good friends will find themselves on opposite political sides when the Civil War comes.
And Stevens is well known for his speech right at the beginning of the war and kind of set the tone for the Confederacy. Do you remember what that speech was all about?
Yeah, that's what's referred to as the famous cornerstone speech, where Alexander Stevens tells the country essentially that the cornerstone of the Confederacy, the reason, the rock, the bedrock of the Confederacy is slavery. And he makes it crystal clear that the reason the war is being fought is not for states' rights, not because they're being taxed too much, but to preserve the institution of slavery. And as you know, his good friend Abraham Lincoln felt otherwise and wrote him letters to express his own point of view. The cornerstone speech by Vice President Alexander Stevens, who was always described as a thin, small, cadaverous-looking man. He weighed less than 100 pounds for most of his life, and although he was a brilliant man and a very generous man, there wasn't much to him.
Cadaverous is not a good thing to be known as, I wouldn't think.
No, I'm hoping no one refers to me as cadaverous anytime soon.
Now, I don't think we have time to discuss all 16 members of the cabinet of Jefferson Davis, but can you give us a little bit of bio on some of the more interesting characters?
There are lots of interesting characters. One name that comes to mind is Howell Cobb. While not technically a member of the cabinet, he was considered the father of the Confederacy, a slaveholder in Georgia. He had 1,000 slaves, slavery being the bedrock of the Confederate fight, had 1,000 slaves, and he was the first father of the Confederate Congress. He was the first provisional president, as it were. Some people refer him to the first president of the Confederacy. So Howell Cobb from Georgia is a name worth remembering. He would fight at the Battle of South Mountain. He'll leave the Confederate government and fight not far from Charlestown in the Battle of South Mountain prior to the campaign. So his name is worth knowing more about. One of the names that's most closely associated with the Confederate government is a name that many people recognize, Judah Benjamin.
Right.
Judah Benjamin from Louisiana, considered the brains of the Confederacy. Now, he was an interesting man for a variety of reasons. He was a brilliant attorney, but he was also Jewish. And that alone set him apart from most of the politicians in the South. But he was a brilliant man, and truth be told, his thinking about how to win the war, had it been followed, might have been a successful strategy for the South. You see, the South's number one agricultural export was cotton,
right.
King cotton. And Judah Benjamin understood the value of that economic force. And his philosophy was, why don't we take these millions of bales of cotton and sell them to Europe? We'll use the money to buy guns. We'll use the money to buy ships. We'll use the money to buy bullets, and we'll defeat the North through strength of arms. But Confederate President Jefferson Davis had other ideas. His idea was withhold the sale of cotton to Europe. They'll be forced to recognize the existence of the Confederacy and will be forced to come in on our side. Well, they never did come in on the side of the Confederacy. England and France pretty well stayed out of the fight. And as a result, the Confederacy was deprived of much of the armament that they might have otherwise made use of. So Judah Benjamin, the brains of the Confederacy, might have done better had they followed his good thinking.
How about some of the other important members?
Well, the Secretary of the Navy was Stephen Mallory. Stephen Mallory once lived at Key West, Florida. Not a bad place to be from, Key West, Florida. Stephen Mallory, Secretary of the Navy. While the Navy the Confederacy will have will not nearly approach the size of the Union Navy, he will come up with some really innovative ideas. He'll come up with some ironclad ships that will fight at Newport News, Virginia in 1862, the fight between the Monitor and the Merrimack. So he's responsible for ships that will become ironclad and will change the way navies operate into the future. And he'll also be involved in the development of an innovative weapon, one of the very first submarines, the USS Hunley.
Right.
So Stephen Mallory, a brilliant man from Florida, representing the state of Florida, will come up with some innovative ideas to advance forward the ideas of the Confederacy, and those ideas will be later used in later wars. So he's one worth noting. It's also interesting to read about some of the other people that were in that Confederate government, like George Randolph. Now, that's a name not a lot of people are familiar with, but in the 19th century, they would have known who he was. He would function as the Secretary of War for a time, George Randolph. But who knew he was the grandson of Thomas Jefferson, George Randolph, and he'll serve as the Secretary of War, one of those famous Virginia families. And then you have the name of John C. Breckinridge. John C. Breckinridge. He was
Vice President to James Buchanan.
Maybe the youngest vice president in our nation's history. He was 35 years old when he became the vice president of the United States to James Buchanan, who was the predecessor to Abraham Lincoln as the president. But John C. Breckinridge would serve as Secretary of War for a time. So here's the vice president of the United States seceding and literally leading.
Right. That's amazing.
The other side, he's probably best known for his when he left the cabinet. He too will join the Confederate Army, and he'll fight at the Battle of Newmark, Virginia, sometimes known as the Battle of Lost Shoes, involving those VMI students.
I think he had a brother that also fought, didn't he?
He may well have had a brother. I'm not as familiar with his brother as I am with John C. Breckinridge.
I think he did. Yeah. Not too many people. That served vice president also served in the Confederate cabinet.
Yeah, and as I remember right, he and his brother were both from Kentucky originally. And curiously, so was Abraham Lincoln, and so was Confederate President Jefferson Davis. So those Kentucky roots were strong, the Breckinridges and otherwise.
How about some of the other important and interesting members from your book?
Yeah, well, we can also talk about Christopher Memminger. You know, three different people in the Confederate cabinet were born out of the country, including Christopher Memminger, who was born in Germany, came across the Atlantic Ocean as an immigrant, and somehow this immigrant became important in South Carolina politics, and he would be appointed Secretary of the Treasury. You might remember Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury was Salmon P. Chase from Ohio. Salmon P. Chase will introduce some innovative economic changes, including the very first paper money used in this country, known as greenbacks. Christopher Memminger didn't have the same wherewithal that Salmon Chase had. And throughout the existence of the Confederacy, he'll struggle trying to provide the money that the Confederate armies needed to buy their arms, buy their ships, and keep on going. Christopher Memminger will ultimately, as Secretary of Treasury, be forced to produce more and more and more paper money to help pay for the goods and services and soldiers that were equipping the Confederacy. And the more paper that those printing presses turned out, the less each and every piece of paper was worth.
Right.
And inflation would go up dramatically, and by the end of the war, it was almost a joke that Confederate money was worthless.
Right?
Christopher Memminger struggled as Secretary of the Treasury, never really able to come up with a way to make sure that the Confederacy had the money they needed to keep the war going.
Now, you said that he was one of the members that was born outside the country. Who were the other two?
Yes, Stephen Mallory was also born outside the country. And I'll have to think this through as to who the other one was. I believe it may well have been Judah Benjamin.
Yeah, I believe Judah Benjamin.
Judah Benjamin.
That rings a bell for me. So I think, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I think that anybody that was the Secretary of the Treasury might have had some problems in the Confederacy because of the blockade was crippling all of their supplies and everything. So I think that maybe anybody with that job probably would have had a difficult time during the war.
Yeah, without a doubt, because the Union blockade on the Atlantic seaboard, it was difficult for the Confederacy to get the supplies they needed. Citizens in the South were starving.
Right.
Soldiers were not getting the equipment and uniforms that they needed. And the money was nearly worthless.
Right.
So those folks selling those sort of goods and services weren't giving very much for piles of cash.
Right. It sounds to me like Abraham Lincoln asked his cabinet members for advice, but often didn't take it. And it sounds like in the Confederate cabinet, Jefferson Davis wasn't listening to his cabinet much either.
Yeah, I guess you could say that Lincoln and Davis were similar in that regard. Certainly Lincoln had his own ideas about how to conduct business, but Lincoln would always get the views of his cabinet, even if he didn't always follow those views. But Jefferson's Davis cabinet not only didn't always provide their views, but sometimes their views were so different from Jefferson Davis, they would actually serve to undermine him. So for example, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens from Georgia, disagreed with the implementation of the draft in the Confederacy. You know, the very first conscription in this country was in 1862, and it was the Confederate government that introduced the draft in this country when they had trouble getting enough soldiers into the Confederate Army. And Alexander Stephens greatly disagreed with Jefferson Davis's policy of implementing the draft. He felt that it was preventing liberty from establishing itself throughout the Confederacy. It was actually undermining free people to force people into the military. So he would leave Richmond, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, and spend most of the years of the Civil War in Georgia telling people of his own political views, which were polar opposites to Jefferson Davis's. He also believed that was true of habeas corpus, you know, the policy that Jefferson Davis promoted, saying that if people were traitors to the Confederacy, they could be locked up without regard to trial and due process. And again, Alexander Stephens, without understanding the context, would greatly criticize the efforts of Jefferson Davis on that policy. So you had a lot of people inside the Confederate government working to undermine the very policies that the Confederate president was trying to promote. And while Lincoln did have internal dissatisfaction, it certainly wasn't to that degree.
Well, and Mr. Lincoln got a bad rap for locking people up for no regard.
At one point, we don't know that
Jefferson Davis did the same thing.
Yeah, at one point, Lincoln was known to have made sure that the whole legislature in the state of Maryland was locked up so that they couldn't vote for secession.
Absolutely. They never did. They never did vote.
No, keep them in the Union, Lincoln said.
That's right. So what were some of the more important decisions made at the cabinet level?
Well, of course, probably the first and most important decision made at cabinet level was the attack on Fort Sumter in April of 1861. You know, Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor had become a flashpoint for both the North and the South. And Abraham Lincoln was determined to make sure that if a war was to break out, the North wouldn't be blamed for firing the first shots. Well, the Confederate cabinet debated the issue about the resupply of Fort Sumter, or in any case, making sure that Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor would be taken away from the federal government and given to the Confederacy. And there was a great deal of disagreement in the Confederate cabinet about what to do. It was Robert Toombs and others who said, for goodness sakes, don't fire on Fort Sumter, South Carolina, or we'll be blamed for having started the war. Abraham Lincoln was able to maneuver those cabinet members into doing just that. General Beauregard fired against Fort Sumter, and that started the war, and the Confederates got blamed for firing the first shot. So it gave Lincoln the political high ground.
Right. Well, what about some of the more other important decisions made by the cabinet?
Well, of course, there was the invasion of Pennsylvania in 1863, when Jefferson Davis and his Secretary of War, James Seddon, debated whether or not to move into Pennsylvania. You had on one side, you had Robert E. Lee saying he needed to invade Pennsylvania to force a political settlement to the war. And the other side of the argument, you had men like John Reagan, who was the Postmaster General, and James Seddon, generally arguing that invading Pennsylvania wasn't the best Southern strategy. Perhaps they ought to send troops out to make sure that the Mississippi River didn't fall into Union hands. So there was a big debate among people within the Confederate cabinet. Ultimately, Robert E. Lee would win the argument. He'll invade Pennsylvania. Unfortunately for the Confederates, General U.S. Grant will capture the Mississippi River despite the advice that Jefferson Davis was getting from his cabinet. And control of the Mississippi River will essentially split the Confederacy in two.
I did not know that that was a cabinet decision to invade the North. It makes sense, but I guess I thought that that was the field general's prerogative, but I guess in a decision like that, Lee didn't want that decision. He wanted it to be made on a higher level, I would think.
Yeah, I would think he wanted it at a higher level. He certainly needs to have the go-ahead of Jefferson Davis.
Right.
And Jefferson Davis is going to consult with members of his cabinet before he makes a final decision as to whether or not Lee can move ahead with the invasion that he likes. And then throughout the war, the Confederate cabinet, this revolving door that the Confederate cabinet was, will ill serve Jefferson Davis.
How would you evaluate Jefferson Davis as a leader?
You know, it's interesting to look at Jefferson Davis. He was born in Kentucky, like Abraham Lincoln was. Abraham Lincoln will go on to become a prominent attorney. You know, be raised on his father's Indiana farm, leaving Kentucky, later established a law practice in Springfield, Illinois, and become a prominent attorney. Some people say he was a prominent lobbyist. But in any case, Abraham Lincoln, a self-made man, went on to a political career and a legal career. Jefferson Davis took a different way to go. He had been born in Kentucky as well. But rather than go towards politics, he gravitated towards the plantation life. His brother had a plantation near Vicksburg, Mississippi, and Jefferson Davis would establish his own residence there and become a prominent attorney. And then when the Mexican War came, he served leading Mississippi troops in the Mexican War. So he became a prominent soldier. Lincoln had little or no military career to speak of, but Jefferson Davis had a prominent military career, so prominent he was considered kind of a war hero and was appointed Secretary of War under Franklin Pierce. Because he had been the Secretary of War, people knew that he knew a lot about moving soldiers into combat, and when the Civil War came, he seemed like a natural selection to fight the Civil War. Somebody who had been the Secretary of War, who had found economic prosperity in the South, understood the value of cotton and the value of slaves, and he will move into a political career, but not before he had first been a prominent soldier and the Secretary of War. So the two men born in similar circumstances in Kentucky will move in several different directions. And one thing they'll share in common is they'll both marry well. Abraham Lincoln will marry Mary Todd Lincoln, the wife of a prominent Kentucky man. Mary Todd Lincoln, who would run into best social circles in Louisville and Lexington, would provide Abraham Lincoln with the support he needed, the support that any politician and prominent man needs from his spouse. And we can say that Jefferson Davis also married well. He first married Sarah Knox Taylor, who was the daughter of Zachary Taylor, a war hero and later president. And then he would marry, after her death, he would marry Verena Howell Davis. And although she was much younger than him, she too came from a prominent family, and she too provided great help and support to Jefferson Davis. So both men married well, although they began their careers and went in diverging directions.
So how about Jefferson Davis as a leader with that experience? Why did he have so much difficulty?
Well, one of the things he was believed to be was a meddler in military affairs. He had been the Secretary of War. He had been a prominent soldier. And, you know, the office of the Secretary of War in the Confederate cabinet included four different people over those 4 years. Leroy Walker, George Randolph, James Seddon, and John Breckinridge. They all became Secretary of War. And looking back, they would say, well, one of the reasons we decided to leave the office of Secretary of War is because we didn't have anything to do. Right. Jefferson Davis wanted to put his fingers into every piece of that pie and direct everything we were doing. So we said, what the heck? If he's going to control the cabinet, the Secretary of War, then maybe we ought to just join the Army where we have a little more independence. Right. So Jefferson Davis probably wanted to be the Secretary of War. He found himself as the president of the Confederacy, but I think maybe he was always a little frustrated that he wasn't closer to military matters and would jump in to help direct the military. Of course, one of his favorite generals was Braxton Bragg, who fought out in the Western Theater. And one of the pieces of information I found, Bob, that was so interesting to me, is that one of the members of the Confederate cabinet was named Thomas Bragg, unbelievably the brother of Braxton Bragg.
Oh, no.
So what better way to become a Confederate general than to have your brother in the cabinet?
So
when we read today's newspapers and today's headlines and see what's going on in the government today, the more things change, the more they remain the same.
Yeah, and we think fake news is new.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I have actually a question. So the cabinet members in the South, following the war, did they find that their participation in the cabinet kind of, and I suppose there'll be a different answer for them as men, but did they find their participation in the cabinet helped them in their careers in life, or did they find that was that like a harmful legacy for them?
Most of them would find that service in the Confederate government, curiously, would help their careers and their political aspirations. Because after the war was over, when the country came back together, and after the Southern states were readmitted to the Union, all those prominent Southern politicians who had been so prominent in the government before the war became prominent once again. So you had people like Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, resuming his congressional career following the war. So many of these politicians who were literally traitors to the country when the country came back together in a way that Abraham Lincoln would describe at one point as let them up easy. They would get up and they would rejoin the country and rejoin those Confederate governments and rejoin the Congress of the United States. Of course, their interests would continue to diverge from those of Northern states in the era of Reconstruction.
That was a great question, Mark, and something that I would not have guessed what the answer was going to be, because I didn't think that these guys would take advantage of their status in the Confederate government to be successful later.
Interestingly enough, Alexander Stevens even became governor of Georgia.
Wow. How about that? Can you tell my listeners about some of your other books and how they might purchase them?
I sure can. I have three books. One is called Abraham Lincoln and His Cabinet. It's kind of a companion piece to Team of Rivals. In Team of Rivals by Doris Kern Goodwin, she talks a lot about Salmon Chase, and she talks a lot about William Seward and what they brought to the table. But she doesn't talk a lot about some of the other politicians in Lincoln's cabinet, like the notorious scoundrel Simon Cameron, who had been the Secretary of War. But his story is every bit as interesting as any of the others. So I tried to identify all the people who had been in Abraham Lincoln's cabinet and put it in one place so that we would have a better understanding of all the personalities in that team. And after that, I pulled together the book Jefferson Davis and His Cabinet to tell the other side. If Lincoln's team was successful, what were the people in the Confederacy? Who were they? And how did they function in the Confederate cabinet? And the reason I did both of these books is because this information is curiously hard to find. There are very few books that talk about the politics of the Civil War, much less about the cabinet members. And this puts all that information in one place, so you have a ready reference to who was in the cabinet and what their contributions were. And now my most recent book has to do with the Battle of Gettysburg. You know, there people have come to the – when you discuss the Battle of Gettysburg, you might imagine that it was 3 days in the summer of 1863. Recent scholarship, including some books by Kent Masterson Brown and some others, tell us, no, Lee's retreat was also important. So when Lee retreated from Gettysburg in the book Retreat from Gettysburg by Brown, he talks about the events that take place from July 4th, 1863 to July 14th, 1863, when Lee crossed the Potomac River and war continued as he moved into Virginia. So it's not a 3-day battle. It's not a 2-week campaign. What I did was pull together all the other information that takes place in 1863 that impacts on these armies. So what happened after Lee retreated into Virginia were there any other battles until both armies went into winter camp in 1863 and early 1864? So I talk about the conclusion of the Battle of Gettysburg, the Battle of Monterey Pass, which was the second biggest battle ever fought in Pennsylvania, involved 20,000 troops as Lee's army retreated over mountain passes. I talk about some of the fighting in Hagerstown, Maryland, that took place when Lee was moving towards Virginia. I talk about the Battle of Falling Waters that took place as Lee's army crossed the Potomac and at Falling Waters and then Williamsport. And then I continue the story by talking about the Battle of Manassas Gap in July of 1863. It involved 18,000 soldiers, and people rarely even mention that that fight that took place. And I continue with lots of cavalry actions in Funkstown and Boonesboro. I talk about fighting that took place in October of 1863 at the Battle of Bristow Station and the Battle of Mine Run later that year. So it's a longer-term look, and you quickly come to the conclusion that when Robert E. Lee crossed the Potomac, he wasn't done fighting,
right.
And neither was General George Meade.
And the name of that book is?
After Gettysburg, Lee Retreats and Meade Pursues.
And where can people get copies of your book?
Sold in almost all the bookstores in and around the Gettysburg area. Also sold at a bookstore in Mechanicsburg, Civil War and More.
Right.
I believe you've had the
James
owner of that
on.
Store here right. on this podcast. You can also find those books on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Okay. And how about an indication of where you might be speaking soon?
I do an awful lot of historical presentations. We just finished one at the Grand Army of the Republic Museum in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I've spoken at Civil War roundtables and historic groups up and down the Eastern Seaboard from Florida north. Coming up in the next few months, I'll be in Lancaster, Pennsylvania in August. I'll be in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania later this fall, and a variety of other Civil War roundtables in between. June and July and August, you can find me almost every day on the Gettysburg battlefield while I'll
right.
be conducting tours in the national park.
And how can somebody reach you if they want to get you to speak to their group?
That's a great question. I would love to speak to any group that would love to have me. You can find me on the internet. Just Google my name, Joseph Mikowski. You can find me at the Lincoln Leadership Institute. I'm on the faculty of the Lincoln Leadership Institute in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and you can reach me through that organization. We conduct leadership training for corporate and executive groups from around the world, government managers and so on. So you can reach me at the Lincoln Leadership Group. And maybe if you have interest in leadership training, I can work with you given my background in government and serving the corporate world. We use historical metaphors, including lots of tours in and around the Gettysburg area.
Now, if they're going to Google you, you're going to have to tell them how to spell your name.
I sure can. You can find me at Joseph Mikowski at yahoo.com. That's J-O-S-E-P-H-M-I-E-C as in cat, Z as in zebra, K-O-W-S-K-I at yahoo.com. Or I'm sure, Bob, if they contact you, you can send
Absolutely.
Them in the right direction.
Absolutely. Will you be able to return next week to speak on with one of your other hats as a licensed battlefield guide at Gettysburg National Battlefield?
I'd love to tell people more about what it's like to work in America's favorite battlefield, the Gettysburg National Park.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. This weekend's events include a free lecture by National Park historian emeritus Ed Beers at Monocacy National Battlefield in Frederick, Maryland. I guarantee you that will be excellent. There's a living history set up at Kernstown Battlefield just south of Winchester, Virginia, from 10 to 3:30 on Saturday, and a lecture about Confederate piracy on the high seas at the Mariners Museum in Newport News, Virginia. That's on Saturday at 2:30. I will be speaking on Saturday and Sunday at the commemoration of the Stonewall Jackson raid on the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Roundhouse in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Saturday, my talk is on brother fighting against brother. On Sunday, my talk will be about James Hanger, the war's first amputee. Today's little-known fact about the American Civil War is this. Early in the war, there was no official blue and gray uniforms. This made for lots of early mix-ups. Men went to war in their own clothes early on, until the official uniforms became available. In fact, some Confederates wore blue. The traditional Union blue and Confederate gray colors did not occur until several months after the war was already in progress. Today in the American Civil War, on May 10, 1862, Confederate General Thomas Stonewall Jackson died in Gooney Station, Virginia. Jackson had been accidentally shot by his own men near Chancellorsville. His arm had been amputated. He died of pneumonia. He is buried in Lexington, Virginia. Today's quotation from the American Civil War is from President Abraham Lincoln, who said, "I am naturally anti-slavery. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I cannot remember when I did not think so and feel. And yet, I've never understood that the presidency conferred upon me an unrestricted right to act officially upon this judgment and feeling. Today's expression emanating from the American Civil War is one you may have heard of, Sam Hill. Sam Hill was the devil, as in, what in the Sam Hill? Tune in next week to hear my discussion, a second part, with today's guest, Joe Makowski. Joe will speak about being a certified battlefield guide at the Gettysburg National Battlefield. To contact us, please send an email to chronicles@BobOConnorBooks.com. I promise I will personally read every single email. Our first email of the day comes from George Chambers of Petersburg, Virginia. It totally sounded like General Lee had returned to life on your recent podcast. It was an impressive portrayal. Thank you. Our second email is on the same topic. This is from Sally and Sam Holder of Roanoke, Virginia. Alan Stone as General Robert E. Lee is the best of the best. We have run across him several times. He looks the part too. It is good that he has returned from retirement. Here's another email on a subject that appears to be popular. I thought General Lee himself was on your pod. Wow, one of your best shows ever. We loved it. That note was from the Berger family of Lansing, Michigan. Here's one from Thomas Wagner of Erie, Pennsylvania, who evidently wanted to get in the last word on my most famous recent guest. Love General Lee and the portrayal by Alan Stone on your podcast. I saw him several times at Remembrance Day parades in Gettysburg. He's a real Southern gentleman. Thanks to my wonderful producer, Mark Guiney, and today's guest, Joe Makowski. Thanks to you for listening. Tell your friends, have them join us next week, same time, same podcast location, for the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is your host, Bob O'Connor.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again. The sun's low down the sky, Lorena. The frost gleams where the flowers have been.